for the week of July 22nd, 2018. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 417, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Moscow, I'm Michael Giltz.
I don't even want to know why you're in Moscow.
I'm just thinking ahead. Do svidaniya, Sperling.
But anyway,
it's been a stressful week in D.C. and Moscow. It's also been a stressful week in Hollywood. And the couple of good stories out about this. One is a cover story in the Hollywood Reporter. It's called Disruption, Consolidation, Uncertainty, Welcome to Hollywood's Age of Anxiety, which is saying not just the current mega deals that are all changing the landscape, but just for the last decade, Hollywood has been even more stressful than ever. I mean, it's always a precarious business. Nobody has any job security. But people feel like it's getting worse and worse. And one reason is another story in the Hollywood Reporter, this one by Kim Masters. I knew her very, very distantly when I worked as a lackey at Premiere Magazine. But she has a really good piece called The Tough Year Ahead, Why Top Hollywood Execs Are So Spooked. And she zeroes in, as we did, on the HBO story. And she said, dear God, HBO is a crown jewel. It nets $2 billion in profits. It has 140 million subscribers worldwide. It has Game of Thrones, the one show everybody else says, I want the next Game of Thrones. And yet they get new bosses and the guy tells them, hey, you better start shaving up.
Yeah.
So, you're
not doing good enough. Number one is not good enough. You have to be half. You have to be number half.
And if you're not HBO, you're like, dear God, if they're getting pilloried, what's going to happen to me? And Fox said, my God, they watched their price go up. And up and up. And all they could think was, if we're so valuable, why the hell are you selling us? what's up with that? So that brings us to the one big news this week. Comcast, they dropped their bid for Fox. Disney made a bid of Fox for $52 billion. Comcast said, we'll raise you $9 billion or so. Then Disney raised them up again to $71.3 billion. And Comcast said, we're out. They're just going to focus on their bid for Sky TV, the European satellite company, and like, you can have Fox.
Remember when I told you, I wonder if this is just a thing to like,
nope.
I don't think it was. I don't think you make billion-dollar offers like that to drive up the price on somebody else. You better be prepared to put the money down. But it worked.
Disney paid $19 billion more than they wanted to. $19 billion. You can buy a lot of businesses with that money.
And they still don't have Sky. They still don't have Sky.
Not right. And they have to give up. Right. Yeah. No, it's yeah. So we'll see what happens. But that's it's a big week in the box office, isn't it? It's a big week in Hollywood.
Well, I think that just to answer your question as to why are we selling when we're apparently worth so much, you're only worth so much when people actually want you. So there's that. But I also think that the reason that Rupert Murdoch is willing to sell the assets to 20th Century Fox is because he's 87 years old and he knows he's got an empire and he knows he's got at least two sons and a daughter who will all fight over it once it is once he passes away.
So, he did it out of the kindness of his heart.
No. I think he's doing it more as premature estate planning. Uh-huh. Not premature, but you know what I mean.
They don't need any estate plan. They're all worth a lot of money.
Right.
But I'm sure they're all listening to our show, so tell them, what are they going to be hearing about this week?
Well, on this week's Showbiz Sandbox, we've got, not a lot of stories, at least not by our standards. So this episode should only run about, say, 90 minutes. Now, that joke doesn't work because we don't know how long the show is going to last, yet you do, because... You know what? You actually have that little podcast app that probably tells you. In any case, we've got good stories, even if it is a sleepy week in July. We'll start with a chunk of news from China. Parents in China are asking the government to rate movies like the MPAA does in the United States. The government shut down a local version of Saturday Night Live. I guess that spoof of Emperor Xi didn't go over so well. And a survey of the year's top local movies so far, it shows that most of the Chinese films actually lost money. Welcome to the movie biz, China. And hey, after a fallow period, where none of the endless reboots and spin-offs struck our fancy, we've got not one, not two, but three new projects to shake our heads over. In book filter news, that trend continues. Michael will recommend a spin-off from Jane Austen's classic Pride and Prejudice, No zombies this time, just a resentful, overlooked middle sister who might as well be named Jan Brady. Also, some good and bad news from UK Publishing. During our sexual misconduct segment, we've got some major news. A top exec and a top director have been fired, while a tragedy on Broadway is sparking multiple investigations. During Inside Baseball, we'll take a step back from the daily news of TV and note the major trends that continue to transform that area of entertainment. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We have information pulled from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you name it. You are listeners, in fact. And if you wanted to be on the charts this week, if you wanted to be at number 25 for the worldwide box office, you had to gross $800,000. That's exactly where you'll find eighth grade, $800,000 for eighth grade. That's perfect. That's the Bo Burnham directorial debut. I like the guy a lot. Fascinated to see this movie. It hasn't come to my town yet, but it had a good solid opening. If you wanted to be in the top 10, you had to gross $10 million. That's where you'll find Hidden Man, the Chinese gangster film. That's the finale to the Bullet trilogy. That grossed $10 million. But if you wanted to be at the top of the charts, if you wanted to be the number one film in the world, then you had to sing ABBA songs because Mamma Mia, here we go again. Well, here we go again. $76 million worldwide on its opening weekend. Another solid start for another ABBA movie.
$76 million and the film cost, what, $75 million to make, production budget.
That's right. Great weekend when you open up to, more than your movie's budget. That's usually a really good sign.
Right. So now all they're doing right now is kind of collecting on the marketing costs.
Well, of course, they only get half, blah, blah, blah. They need to gross about $250 million worldwide when all is said and done. And then they'll be in the black, but I'm sure they'll get there. At number two around the world is Adam Sandler's animated flick, Hotel Transylvania 3, that grossed $60 million on the weekend, and it's at $206 million worldwide. So by next weekend, it will have easily tripled its budget, which was about $80 million. At number three is The Incredibles 2, another $50 million on the weekend. That movie is at $940 million worldwide. So there's no question this movie is going to blow past the $1 billion mark. It'll be, what is it, the third or fourth film this year? Is it the fourth or fifth? I mean, well, what do we have? We had Black Panther, Jurassic World. Now we're going to have Incredibles 2. Were there any others? Oh, yeah, of course. Avengers Infinity War. Those are the three. Is this the fourth?
I think it might be.
There's not a fifth one lurking around there, is there?
I don't know, but think about it. It made $48 million this weekend alone. And it's like, how many weeks has it been out already?
It's been out a few, but it's making a lot of money and it's still going strong.
I mean, it made $11.5 million in the United States this week. Ant-Man and the Wasp, okay, and its third week is making 16.1 in the U.S.
Well, yeah, they're both doing great. You know, it's not a competition. At number four is Equalizer 2, the first sequel in Denzel Washington's career, mainly because he doesn't make the sort of movies that, call for sequels. You know, he's an actor, damn it. But this movie, this is a franchise in the making, and it's clearly got one. $40 million on its opening weekend. So that movie, we may very well see an Equalizer 3. At number five is Skyscraper, another Dwayne Johnson flick. $40 million on the weekend, $140 million worldwide and counting. Most of that money came from China, where the movie opened up pretty strongly. However, this movie's going to struggle, I think, to get to $375 million. It'll get close enough that it'll be a wash, but this is not one of his bigger success stories. That's certainly not the case for The Ant-Man and the Wasp. That is a hit. $40 million on the weekend, $350 million worldwide. This movie is going to gross more than the original in North America. We'll have to see how it does overseas. But I think it's got, the Variety said it has 56% of the market still to go. Or it's open in 50%. Oh, I'm sorry. It's open in 56% of all markets. Now, I don't know whether they're weighting them, meaning, 56% of the total box office. Because, if you open up in the U.S. and China, you may still have 80% of the market to go. But a lot of those territories can come even close to the US and China. So I'm not sure how they're doing that number, but you know, they've got 40% of the world to go. Even if they're small markets, the money adds up. So Ant-Man and the Wasp, you know, it has a ways to go to match the original, but it's certainly doing well. At number seven is Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. That's at $1.2 billion worldwide. No need to say more than that. And at number eight, Dying to Survive. This is the Chinese dark comedy that is rewriting the rule books for Chinese flicks. $25 million on the weekend, $413 million worldwide. And by worldwide, we mean China. It's open in one territory, so it is really tearing it up. And in fact, it made more news. The premier of China, who's sort of the equivalent of maybe the Senate majority leader. I mean, it doesn't really mean much since China is a one-party state and now, frankly, a dictatorship. But he's way high up in the government. And the premier of China is urging government agencies to speed up price cuts on drugs to fight cancer. That is happening because of this movie. That's kind of amazing. At number nine is The First Purge, $13 million on the weekend. That's about to break the $100 million mark. It looks like this film will do like all the others. Every Purge film has grossed more than the one that came before. That means there will be another one. We already talked about Hidden Man. That's the Chinese gangster flick. That's at $75 million worldwide. Below that is another sort of heist gangster flick in a way. Ocean's 8, more of a caper film, I should say. That's still chugging along. $260 million worldwide. Below that is Sicario, Day of the Soldado. That's at $67 million worldwide. Oh my God, I forgot to look this up. Animal Crackers. I don't know what this movie is. I forgot to look it up. It's $3.6 million on its opening weekend. Normally, I would have said, all right, I would have looked for the IMDb link, or I would have looked for a trailer. I would have tried to figure out what's the film, what's it about, who's in it. It escaped my mind. So if you know what Animal Crackers is, and I'm assuming it's not a remake of the Marx Brothers film, call us.
Yes, you can call us at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Now, you might be wondering, Animal Crackers is a 2017 American-Spanish-Chinese 3D computer animated comedy fantasy film. That's a lot of adjectives for one movie.
Who made this film? I mean, Emily Blunt is a voice person in it.
And John Krasinski, her husband, and Danny DeVito, Ian McKellen, Sylvester Stallone is in it.
That's just for the American dubbing, or is that who originally made the film? I mean, if it's an animated film, that's just the American voice cast.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, you said it was a Chinese co-production, or who?
Oh, actually, no. It's a Chinese-Spanish co-production, and yes, that's the original cast.
No, I'm sorry. Is it live action or animated?
It is animated, and it opened in China.
Oh, okay. All right. So it's an animated film. What's it about? Do you see?
Animals that eat themselves in the form of crackers. No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, we'll keep exploring that, but it's nice to know that animal crackers still have a life. I'm still singing the Shirley Temple song in my head right now.
Actually, in China, it's called Animal World.
Animal World. It's nice to watch us do our research live on the air. Very exciting. And number 14 is Unfriended Dark Web, a sequel to the horror flick or thriller, whatever you want to call it, of Unfriended. This one is also a micro-budget film. $1 million is the budget, and that's lucky because they were hoping for a much bigger opening, but it only opened to $3.5 million in North America. They were hoping for like $15 million, you know, something like that. They were hoping for a great opening, but this one is not clicking like the first one. Got pretty poor reviews, should probably disappear fast, but it won't matter because they didn't spend a lot on it. That's not the case for Sorry to Bother You. The Boots Riley flick is doing great. Expanded to some more screens. It's at $2.8 million on the weekend. It passed the $10 million mark. We don't really know the budget. Somewhere in the seven-figure range, probably lower rather than higher. So it's going to do great, that numbers-wise. Critics love it. Audiences are glomming onto it. I don't think this is going to have a big, long run. I don't think this has I think there's a ceiling to this movie because I've seen it, and it's a heck of a lot wackier than I expected. So kudos to everyone who kept a lid on this movie. I mean, that's pretty impressive in this day and age. because I had no clue where this movie was going. And that doesn't happen a lot, but it is slightly near futuristic. It's satirical, kind of like Office Space. A very strong cast. I admired it. I liked it. It's not the home run I was hoping for, but it is a home run commercially and with critics, and it's doing well with audiences. So I am definitely looking forward to Boots Riley's next film. And number 16 is Tag, the guys who are adults and yet still play tag. $70 million on the weekend. And looking for something new to talk about, there is a film I did look up. It's Mad Mom, French Marim. It's a French comedy about a mother taking on the bullies who are targeting her 9-year-old son. Good for her. $1.5 million on its opening weekend. And a couple documentaries right below it, Three Identical Strangers and Won't You Be My Neighbor, both made about $1.4 million this weekend. You know what? That's a great lifetime gross for a documentary film, and they made that in one weekend. Three Identical Strangers moving up the charts in North America. Won't You Be My Neighbor still holding steady. That's at $18 million. That's going to pass the $20 million mark. That's a great, huge success story.
Well, you mentioned Dying to Survive, you know, this Chinese film that's going gangbusters over there. It was finally beat out by Skyscraper, the release of Skyscraper this week in China, but not by much. And you know how that film and its success has it's caused that the premier of China to urge for price cuts of cancer drugs, but there's other stuff going on in the Middle Kingdom.
Well, that's right. I mean, perhaps, you know, this movie is a dark comedy. It's really for adults. And there may be some parents who weren't sure, would there be bad language in it? Will there be any nudity or sex? You know, they don't know. Or, you know, the sex would be very tame by American standards, I imagine and assume. But they don't want to see any suggestion of sex, or who knows what, you know, the parents have different desires. Depends how old you are. And so people are saying in China, hey, we should have a rating system, just like they have in America. Right now, every movie in China is supposed to be acceptable for everybody. We have those Rambo-type movies that had a lot of military action, which you wouldn't want to bring a small child to. But, you know, people don't know. So they want the government to step in and say, give us a rating system. I was going to suggest, hey, maybe the studios should step in and do it on their own before the government does. But that's stupid because there's no distinction really between the studios and the government, right? It's all one distributor.
Well, it's
all
like controlled by one, the government. One, maybe two or three. Yeah. I mean, right. It's mostly controlled by the government. And if you're not controlled by the government, you're basically controlled by the government.
Right. And the great thing would be if they did do a rating system, whoever was in charge of it, that could open up to the release of more movies like Dying to Survive, movies that are appropriate for people who aren't 8 years old. You know, you don't want every movie made to be appropriate for 8 years old. That's just dumbing down your movies. You want to make great films. You want to appeal to a wide audience. You better have a diverse range of movies. And that means some movies are just kind of appropriate for teens, and maybe some are just appropriate for adults.
Well, when the heads of the National Association of Theater Owners went over to Saudi Arabia when Saudi Arabia last year began to open its market for movie theaters, and they opened their first movie theater in 30 some odd years earlier this year in February, I believe, they suggested almost immediately, look, you have to create a rating system. China didn't do it. It's been a huge problem. And
for Americans, not for them.
No. Even for the Chinese, it's been an issue since nobody knows whether you're sending films in or whether you're distributing films. You don't know what you're going to get. You can't signal to parents whether something is appropriate or not. And that's exactly what the rating system here in the United States was meant to do. That's what it's meant to do in other parts of the world. And that is what NATO was trying to explain to Saudi Arabia. And they have long asked for a rating system in China. Most of the studios here in the U.S. would really love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what they'd also love to have is a lot more success. They're finding out that, you know what, it's hard making movies that make a lot of money. There was a survey of the top 50 movies of the year so far in the Middle Kingdom, and the breakdown, according to one website, and we didn't really have access to their opinion on what the budgets might be and how much they gross and how much the studios get from the gross. You know, we don't have any of that info. We could sort of assume maybe it's kind of like North America, but we just don't know. But according to one company covering the Chinese industry, they say they looked at the top 50 movies of the year so far, and these are the Chinese made films, and they said 12 made a profit, 6 probably broke even, and 32 lost money. And you know what? It's like, hey, welcome to the movie business, right? That sounds about right.
I've been trying to find this study that you're speaking of, and I'm trying. I can't find
it. Oh, did I not link to it? I'm so sorry. It was, you know, China Insider Daily. Do you not? I got it from China Insider Daily, which linked to the story. I will get it before we'll have it in the show notes by the time we put the notes up on the online for people to find. It was in Chinese, so there was just a one paragraph description of it, and then when you linked to the story, it was in Chinese. It was in Mandarin or whatever. I did Google Translate, and it was, you know, they would translate some of the text around it, which was a little rough, but the actual data and information, you couldn't tell what number belongs to what. So it was a little hard to parse. So that's probably why I didn't link to it, because it wasn't in English. My question is that, okay, you know, 18 movies broke even or made a profit right off the bat. Well, that's, you know, that's pretty good. You know, more than a third, right? About a third of the movies were hits at the box office out of the bat, and two thirds were not a hit right off the bat. The question is, though, what kind of a safety net do they have? In the U.S., for decades now, we've had a big safety net. First, it was VHS tapes and the blockbuster rental market. Then it was the sell-through market. Then it was DVDs and Blu-rays. Now it's streaming and video on demand and all these other ways, and cables, channels, and all this competition for your movies. Netflix, Hulu, everybody's paying big money to get a movie library, to show them on their cable channel, to show them on HBO. You know, there's a lot of money to be made post-film. And I'm wondering if they have that same safety net in China. And of course, they don't worldwide. They can market their movies throughout Asia, but as of yet, their movies are not making a lot of money on a regular basis in, say, North America and a lot of other territories. They can make money in South Korea and maybe Japan and India. I wonder, I don't look at the charts for India, but I'd love to know, are Chinese films breaking through in India the way we see Indian films break through in China? So I'm guessing they have much less of a safety net, because in the Chinese market, there's probably not as much competition to show libraries of Chinese movies on TV, right? They don't have the same wheeling and dealing that we do.
No, not well. Certainly, they don't have the same ticket
price.
I'm
saying after the movies, they don't have, you know, 100 cable channels vying to buy the rights to their movie to show them on their cable channel. They don't have the video on demand at the same level we do. So, and they also don't have the worldwide market. So, there's a lot less margin for error. In the U.S., we know, hey, if your movie doesn't make it back in North America, you've got the rest of the world box office, and then you've got the aftermarket where you can make more money. So all these movies that don't make money right off the bat, we know they're going to make up a lot of ground. The Dwayne Johnson film being a great example. It's not going to make its money back at the box office, probably not right off the bat, but they're not going to lose money on Skyscraper.
No one's going to rake in
big bucks, but they've got a lot of ways to make up that money.
And I did find the English language version of that article, and you were correct in all of the numbers that you cited. 32 movies lost money.
Okay, I'm not going to even try to say this, so I'm just going to try to play it to you through my microphone. Are you ready, Sperling?
I'm ready. I have no idea what you're going to do now. Nothing is playing. I have no idea what you just did.
Oh, you didn't hear that?
No.
Oh, shoot. Well, it said, Zhu Zhai Beijing, Zhe Xi Jingkui Wangshang, or live from Beijing, it's Saturday night.
Wow. Did they literally call it Live from Beijing? It's Saturday night?
It's Saturday Night Live. That's the name of the show. SNL has franchised their show around the world, and China picked one up. And people are like, really?
Wait, first of all, are you sure that it's SNL that's kind of farming this out or franchising?
Yes,
okay,
yes,
it's not
yes,
just like
yes.
ripped
no,
off.
It is an actual official, you know, local version of Saturday Night Live, because there were quotes from, you know, the studio, you know, Paramount or whatever, whoever's behind SNL. I forget now. I shouldn't say
NBC.
Paramount. Well, NBC, but I don't know what the...
Universal NBC.
Yeah. So there were quotes from them when this show was yanked. So they started the show just a few weeks ago, and they've already pulled it off the air. So that wasn't a good sign. It seems to be for not any particular skit, but just general content. The government, in a separate statement, but happening around the same time, is demanding on television that there be more content with, quote, positive energy, end quote, for teens, and that programmers avoid low-taste and harmful programs, especially during summer vacation when kids are watching. And, like, that's our wheelhouse, right? You know, low-taste and harmful programs, that's what television is. But, yeah, they want cleaner and better programming. people were giving the show sort of poor reviews, but we know with sketch comedy shows, it really takes a while to get on your feet. So that's not really fair. A few weeks into a new show with a cast trying to do improv, topical satire, SNL was almost canceled when it began. It had horrible ratings. Everybody at NBC hated it, and advertisers hated it. Local stations hated it. It had low ratings in part because like 30 or 40 stations just wouldn't carry the show.
In the National Lampoon documentary, there was a documentary about the founding and running of National Lampoon. All the National Lampoon writers went over to work for Saturday Night Live, and everybody thought, you're insane. Why would you leave National Lampoon for this silly TV show, Saturday Night Live? It's never going to last.
Well, the people did have a sense of humor, at least about their show going away. When you went to the website for the show, which appears on the show's Youku page, it said the site you were searching for has just gone to explore Pluto. It's like, okay.
Hey, you know what? They've got a sense of humor and they were comedians, so good on them.
Right, so that was a remake of SNL, or rather a local franchise version of it, but that's not the only story in reboot sequels and spinoffs, is it?
No, I guess here is, it's like a spinoff. It's not a reboot and it's not a sequel. It's The Purge, which already has a string of sequels. One might even call them episodes because they're going to be turned into a TV series. Not those movies, but a brand new TV series on The Purge.
I'm sitting in the theater and I see an ad for The Purge TV show. I'm like, huh? Really? It's like coming in the fall. Seems like overkill to me, but, you know, we can do a purge every week. Seems exhausting.
Get it, overkill, because that's what they're doing on the show.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. Do your kids, have they ever watched Rugrats? Did they miss that era or not care enough to watch them in reruns?
They miss that era, and they do not care enough about them to watch them in reruns.
Do they watch any classic kids shows? Do you show them Pee-wee or Looney Tunes or anything?
Yeah, they liked Looney Tunes and Pee-wee Playhouse. They watch maybe one or two episodes.
Oh, so you're a terrible father. I didn't
Pretty
realize
much.
That.
Well, anyway, I'm a lousy father, yeah.
Yeah, Rugrats is coming back. Nickelodeon has greenlit 26 new episodes of the animated series, and they're also doing a live-action feature film version. So that's interesting.
Who's going to play the kid with the very big head?
A kid with a big head, I guess.
Well, what about this Buffy the Vampire Slayer reboot?
Well, I'm very conflicted. You know, if you're going to do a Joss Whedon show, I want to see Firefly, because that's a show that never got its due. The cast is still around. You could still do this show. I'm dying to see this show. They only did like 11 or 13 episodes, so there's a lot of rich material. Buffy, they did 7 seasons, which was 2 seasons too many. They've done comic books that have extended the story since then. The only good thing is that they're not going to try and start from scratch and redo the show from the beginning. It's going to be a new Buffy Vampire Slayer. She's going to be a person of color, probably a young black woman, so that's going to add something different to the show, but it just feels unnecessary, that's for sure. Buffy, those first 5 years, is one of my favorite shows of all time, so I'm not terribly excited to see them go back to the well on that one. Do Firefly.
Well, you know, look, I thought Buffy the Vampire Slayer was better than Cats. I would see it again and again.
Well, I'd love to see the original show again. Cats, yes, though Cats is coming. A live-action version of Cats directed by Tom Hooper, who did The King's Speech and that dreadful Les Miserables, but that was a success, so they're going to try it again. Taylor Swift, Jennifer Hudson, who's going to be playing the cat singing memory, Ian McKellen, James Corden, hot off his, you know, tour with Paul McCartney. For years, they talked about doing Cats as an animated film. That, to me, was the perfect way to translate Cats into a feature film. That is the only way that makes sense. Theatrically, I have no problem with Cats. I think some of the songs are fine. The revival I saw was not good. I was really excited. It's the first time I got to see the show. It's kind of just a review. And, you know, with talented people, you can knock those songs out of the park. But it's an environmental thing. Actors pretending to be cats. But you're in the theater. But in a film? I mean, animated was the way to go. That seemed really smart to me. And now they're doing a live action version, so God help them all.
Well, those are the projects that are in the pipeline for TV, and I guess we didn't have any movies, did we? No, actually we did. Rugrats, a live action film.
And Cats. That's
and Cats. Movie. Yeah, that Cats is a movie, although with Taylor Swift, yeesh.
She's kind of a popular person there, Sperling.
I know, but I just can't see her acting. Could you see with all that makeup on? Come on.
You don't have to act. You just sing songs. There's no real acting to do. They don't have acting scenes. They don't say, good morning, cat. How are you? All they do is go, midnight, not a sound from the, meow. You know, I mean, that's it. There's no drama. It's just one song after another.
You know, I haven't seen Cats in so long, I barely have a memory of it.
Oh, very funny. But anyway, you're getting onto the book filter section because the reboots and spinoffs and sequels don't stop there. They continue right in book filter.
That's right. Our book filter segment is where you each week kind of bring us a few titles that Hollywood and the entertainment industry should be paying attention to, whether it's for adaptations or sequels and spinoffs, etc. And of course, you're picking these out of the hundreds of thousands of books that are released, if not each week, each year, which, you know, you go through all of these books over on bookfilter.com, but these are the ones that you think, hey, entertainment industry, pay attention, look at these books. What have you got for us this week?
Well, I'm sure they already are with this one. It's called Mary B. by Catherine J. Chen. Great early reviews. It looks like it might be a breakout title. It's her debut book. It's a spinoff on Pride and Prejudice. And Pride and Prejudice has been done as a film, as a miniseries, as another film, as another film, as another miniseries. There have been musical versions of it. It's been done again and again, as it always will, because it's a classic title, one of the greatest novels of all time. And Mary B. tells the story from a different perspective. It's Mary Bennett, who's kind of a pill. She's the unloved middle sister in Pride and Prejudice. Lizzie is dad's favorite. That's our heroine in Pride and Prejudice. Jane is a beauty. She's the oldest one. The younger siblings, Kitty and Lydia, are kind of silly, but at least they're spirited and girlish and kind of pretty. Mary is just this, you know, old maid in waiting. She's scolding. She's moralistic. She's always, you know, wagging her finger at the others. She's really the least fun character in that family. The mother is silly, God bless her. The father is, you know, tries to stay out of the way. And Mary is just a pill. So telling an entire book from her point of view is kind of fun, and it really worked well. One of my critics, Janet Rotter, reviewed the book, absolutely loved it. Everybody else is loving it as well. It's getting great early reviews. I'm looking forward to checking it out myself. It could be one of the big books of the year, and I'm sure it's already been optioned. But if it hasn't, get on the ball.
Well, you know, look, Jane Austen, English writer, right, from the UK. That
quite
kind
true,
of English.
Quite true.
Yes.
Very English.
Now, speaking of the UK, that was my way of kind of pushing us towards this interesting news, in my opinion.
Yes,
about publishing in the UK.
Yeah, but before we do, have you read Pride and Prejudice?
I have, actually.
Well done, well done. Sense and Sensibility?
I have, actually.
Well done again. There's only five Jane Austen novels.
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. I had to take an English literature course, and I don't mean English like the language English. I mean, you know,
we understand.
Dickens, yes. Thackeray. I read Vanity Fair. Now, that is a book that just never ends.
It's not a book I've ever taken to my heart. I must be honest with you. But I did ultimately like it a lot when I read it. It's Madame Bovary that I've never really enjoyed. But Vanity Fair, I liked more when I saw a stage production of it. It sort of woke the book up for me. And then I went back and visited the book again, and it came alive for me. Sometimes seeing a film adaptation, you know, if you haven't read Jane Austen, you know, maybe go see the Emma Thompson version of Sense and Sensibility and then read the book. It might help you get into it. If you have trouble with historic novels, you know, go backwards. It's okay. See the movie first, but then read the book. You'll find more than's in the film, but it might help you visualize and appreciate the humor and the fun of what's in the novel.
I know this is a complete non sequitur, right, that I'm about to say, but, okay. You know, there's always these, when I was in motion picture development, there'd always be this legend that somebody like, you know,
they took Hamlet and slapped a new title on it and everybody rejected it.
Right. Exactly. Like, you know, Casablanca, what's this, yes, you know,
Algiers, they'd call it Algiers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And nobody knew that it was Casablanca. And they were like, I don't know about this. It doesn't really seem, you know, we'll always have Paris. I don't get it. And so I wonder if you took something like Vanity Fair, which is not necessarily something everybody has read, not every development executive will have read that, and basically update it to the modern day, right?
And well, just, you couldn't couldn't update it. You would just have to change the title and the character names. Otherwise, it wouldn't work because it's, you know, then you're rewriting the novel.
Well, yeah.
Then it's a new novel. So that doesn't work. No, people have tried that. They've slapped on classic titles and tried to send it to publishers and report on what happens. Mostly sounds like bunk to me. But, you know, if you can't recognize Casablanca, get out of the business. But anyway, we were trying to segue to the UK. And unlike the US, where the major chains are struggling, well, they may be tottering a little bit in the UK, but there is some good news. Publishing sales have been a little bit down in North America, though the business is essentially strong. It has been down, and our major chains are tottering. In the UK, however, 2017 was the best year ever in terms of total sales. The best year ever. $7.4 billion in business. But guess what? Their biggest market? It isn't the UK. It's overseas. 60% of their sales were overseas. That's like Hollywood. You know, they make a ton of movie in North America. They make more money overseas. You know, that's a great job to have. You have the whole world to want your product at, then you're doing great. Exports are bigger than UK sales for UK books. Culturally, the UK has always punched well above their weight in music, books, film, and TV, and that's a really valuable thing. Their government should continue to invest in the BBC and culture and the theater because it really pays off. In particular, hardback sales are up 31% over last year. I don't know what books are suddenly taking off worldwide, but that's a great number. Audiobooks, interestingly, are a very small slice of the pie, but that format grew substantially, but it's only grew to $40 million, and that's really less than 1% of the entire book market that they have. So I don't know why audiobooks are lagging so far in the UK. It's going by leaps and bounds in North America, and it's a much bigger slice of the pie. And just like in the US, ebook sales grosses fell slightly in the UK. So these are publishing numbers. They don't include self-published books being published by Amazon. So, you know, they do include published books by, you know, major houses and major indie houses that are reporting to the big companies. But they have great news in the UK, and that's that they had the biggest year ever, and they've got the world as their market.
Well, but here's the problem. The people who are actually writing those books, they're making less than ever.
What are the numbers?
Well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, they're making less than the average, of course, the median income, is less than $14,000 a year as an author.
That's frightening. Yeah. That's, you know, obviously most authors, especially when they start or even throughout their careers, have second jobs. You can name famous authors who've had second jobs, like, you know, everybody. So many have had second jobs. The list is endless. So it's not that they shouldn't have to have a second job, but when you're making so little money, you're never going to be able to devote your time full time to writing unless you're one of the lucky few that wins the lottery. And when the publishers are having more profits than ever, you have to wonder why it's not being shared with the author. So it's been a 10-year decline. Their amount has declined by 42% over the last decade. And when your share of the when your income is declining by almost half and your publishers are getting record profits, something is out of whack.
Well, I guess my question is it record profits or record revenue? Those are always two different things. I mean, that you
could
be selling
things,
a lot.
But they're hitting record revenue as well.
Okay, and I know that there are some in the articles that we have from The Guardian that are saying, hey, you know where all that money's going, or at least a good portion of it, is going to celebrity authors, these people like Brooklyn Beckham, who I guess had a coffee table book. I guess, what, is Brooklyn Beckham one of the Beckham's kids or something? I don't even know who Brooklyn Beckham is.
I guess I would just say that, you know, silly celebrity books are always a good part of the mix. You know, you can make a lot of money with them, and that helps support your midlist and your small struggling authors. So not every book can be a literary effort, and it's fine to have those in their mix. But if every penny of yours is just going for junk, that's never going to build a long-term career. You're not doing a good job of creating the right mix for your publishing house. That's for sure.
And here's how you know you're old. Okay, when you read a headline from a month ago that reads, Brooklyn Beckham is dating YouTuber Lexi Pantera, and at least I know what YouTube is, okay? Because I have no idea who Brooklyn Beckham is, I have no idea who Lexi Pantera is, and I probably shouldn't even be admitting that.
In my day, YouTube was cat videos and we were happy.
Get off of my lawn!
Exactly. Well, let's move on to sexual misconduct. We have a couple big stories this week. The first one is intriguing. Amy Powell was fired from Paramount TV for inappropriate comments made at work in a professional setting.
Now, she was the head of Paramount TV.
She was the head of Paramount TV. She's been there for 14 years. She's been the head for the last few years. She has delivered recent big hits like 13 Reasons Why and The Alienist and Jack Ryan, which is just about to open up and has great buzz. She got George Clooney to return to TV to co-star and direct Catch 22, a miniseries. So, she is a very, very important player at Paramount. But apparently, in a meeting talking about a TV reboot of The First Wives Club, that feature film, for TV, it's going to feature a predominantly black cast. And the story reported in the press is that she allegedly made insensitive generalizations about black women. Now, Paramount says, we were going to just discipline her. You know, we took it seriously, but we didn't think it was a firing offense. But when we approached her, she denied making the comments at all. And numerous other people confirmed that she did. And that was just a bridge too far for them. And so, that's why they fired her. You know, when she said, I did not say them. And she said in a public statement, I did not say these comments.
So it's not the crime, it's the cover up.
It's not the crime, it's the cover. The story's not done yet. I'm sure she'll be suing. We'll have to pause and wait. But they said, it was bad enough what she was saying. But when she lied and claimed that she didn't say it, that was something that they found a little more unsettling. And they felt we can't have that.
Well, and, she was a very successful executive for Paramount. And, Jim Giannopoulos is now the head of Paramount. I don't think this is a case where you have a new executive, a new head of the company come in and try and clean house because Amy Powell was doing a good job. So why try and put your own people in there when, for all intents and purposes, you had somebody doing a great job?
Exactly. And you had someone doing a great job on Guardians of the Galaxy, that's for sure. James Gunn has been fired from making Guardians of the Galaxy 3. He was working on the script. He was going to direct, just like he did number 1 and 2, but tweets that he had done over a decade ago, which he has apologized for in the past, have resurfaced. He's acknowledged them, apologized for them, said he was an idiot, and that he is not the person he was before. But before Comic-Con, some conservative websites dug them up again, and they're awful and embarrassing. There are jokes about rape, jokes about pedophilia. They're really just god-awful, not funny at all, and pathetic and lame and embarrassing and everything you might feel. If you were 14, you might say, oh, I was an idiot. But, as an adult to post them is really embarrassing and awful. And it came to surface. They fired him. They just said, you're gone. And he did the best thing you could. He said basically, hey, he put out a couple statements to say he completely accepts what happened. It happened. These tweets were a decade ago. I was trying to be provocative, and that doesn't apologize for them at all. They were pathetic. I completely accept what's happened and why. I want to be a better person. I take full responsibility. He didn't say, I was just a kid. He said, no. I said them. They were wrong then. They're wrong now. I should have done better. I will try to do better in the future. He said everything you could when, hey, you had tweeted this stupid, obnoxious stuff. And, he said, hey, it's not to say I'm better, but I am very, very different than I was a few years ago. Today, I try to root my work in love and connection and less in anger. My days saying something just because it's shocking and trying to get a reaction are over. But that didn't change the fact that they booted him to the curb.
Yeah, and this. I mean, look, I don't know what the tweets were. Nobody has republished them, I've noticed. I haven't really seen any.
My friend read them to me. Yeah, they're really, really off. Yeah, no, he had removed them, of course, from the internet. Once his fame was struck, he didn't want to have that sitting out there. But, everything exists on the Wayback Machine, so everything can be found. And yeah, he didn't deny the tenor of them. They're just incredibly moronic and offensive and stupid. There's just no doubt about it.
Well, even Bo Burnham, right, the guy who did Eighth Grade, who has been on the internet since he was like, 14 years old, 15 years old, says, I watched some of the stuff that I did on YouTube, 10 years ago, and oh my gosh, I was a moron. I'm so embarrassed by it. And was asked, well, why not just take it down? And he said, look, it's on the internet. It's there forever. Why bother taking it down? I just try and do better from this point forward.
I believe he made some jokes about mentally challenged people, Bo Burnham in particular, one or two that I didn't really like, but I thought his wit and talent were clear, and that he went in an interesting, positive direction with his humor. But there's a difference between being embarrassed by something, and not to speak about any particular Bo Burnham joke, and something that's just really offensive and awful. These are like Andrew Dice Clay level attempts at provocativeness. It's just embarrassing and awful stuff. But he is being defended, isn't he?
Yes, so he has some of the actual actors from Guardians of the Galaxy, Dave Bautista and Selma Blair saying, look, you need to hire him back because he's one of the good ones.
Yeah, she said he really supported her and helped her to have the courage to come forward when Me Too was happening. And she wanted to share her story of sexual harassment and everything that happened to her. And he was a very strong presence with her and, you know, said, no, it's really important. She felt he said everything right that she wanted. And she said he has the right set and he's, you know, everything is going on correctly when he's present today. So the one thing I really liked, she said, after sharing a link to a change.org petition, she said, hey, because if people are punished despite changing, then what does that teach people about owning mistakes and evolving? This man is one of the good ones.
Right. And I would agree with that. That's what bothers me about this, is that for all intents and purposes, everybody that has worked with him on these Guardians movies have said, you know what? Either we knew about that and didn't care because he was a completely different person and we never saw that. Or, hey, I didn't even know about that. It's hard to believe that it's the same person. And you know what? If you can't change, if what you did 15 years ago, I mean, certainly if you killed somebody, that's a different story. But if, you know, a joke you made, however poor that joke and offensive that joke may have been, if that's going to stick with you for the rest of your life, then everyone on earth should just keep their mouth shut. Because
do you have to keep bringing up the fact that I was in the KKK? So I was the Imperial Wizard. I mean, come on. There's just a big difference between an actual crime, an act of violence or assault or sexual harassment. And let's, you know, catch our breath. You know, people could still come forward. It's only been a day or two. So people could come forward and say, no, he didn't have a good set. You know, that hasn't happened yet. Catch your breath before you start to say, nobody spoke up. It's like, well, maybe they haven't spoken up yet. So make sure people feel like they can speak up. Do an investigation and say, how was it on those first two films? How about the other projects he's worked on? Does anybody have any issues that they didn't raise? Because you know what? He's a big, powerful guy, and people don't speak up or feel comfortable speaking up, even if there is a poisonous set. So let's find out if there was one, because that's their job, because it's their movies. So they have people they can talk to in the first two films. But I am empathetic with the idea that there's a difference between, you know, well, I'm going to get in trouble with, what's her name?
Roseanne.
Matt Damon's ex-girlfriend.
You're expecting
Minnie
me
Driver.
To
Minnie Driver. Right. She's going to say, hey, you know, nothing's acceptable. Nobody accepts, you know, offensive jokes about rape and pedophilia any more than they accept rape. But there is a difference, and they deserve different levels of punishment. And when did it happen? And what have you done since then? So if you're a commentator on MSNBC and you've spent the last 10 years showing that you have evolved from whatever blog posts you put up a decade ago, then people say, hey, that's why we're cutting you slack, because you've shown yourself to be a champion of LGBTQ rights. And so we put that in context. Or if you've done something that's a crime, we're not going to give you a slack. You know, Roseanne attacked somebody with racist comments. She said, I didn't know they were black. Well, you still are attacking someone in vile, hateful terms. And you've done it again and again and again. And you spread hateful conspiracy theories about, you know, children who were murdered and claiming their parents are liars and these kids never existed or were not really killed. So those are really offensive acts that affect real people. That's different from a random, stupid joke. You know,
well,
there is different
The case with Roseanne is it was happening right there in that moment. You know, it's current. It's
right.
Not from 10
right,
years
but she
ago.
Was attacking someone. She wasn't making a joke in terms of like.
Oh, well, that's true, too.
A joke
yes.
Related to her. She was mocking and attacking and belittling a person with hateful racist demagoguery. She is spreading racist lies about a person who escaped the Nazis and claiming he was a collaborator with Nazis. That's not some random face. Like Mark Zuckerberg. No, dude. When people say there's no Holocaust, that's a hate crime. That's not a random joke or, oh, they made a mistake and it was the wrong year. No, that's actually a hate crime where they're propounding a hatred against Jews because that's the only reason you say the Holocaust didn't happen. But
well,
anyway,
on a
it's
somewhat
ugly,
related
ugly,
note, let me ask you this.
Yeah,
have you seen the Hannah Gadsby comedy special, Nanette, on Netflix?
No.
Okay. Well, for our listeners and for Michael, have a look at that, and I'm sure you'll see how it relates to this conversation.
Okay. Well, there you go. So, yeah, that's an evolving story. We'll have to see what happens. I don't think there's a case of, oh, we've gone too far, and now we need to pull back, and this guy's been saying, no. The studio wants to distance themselves from hateful, you know, offensive rhetoric. That's their job. You know what? They got a $1 billion franchise with Guardians of the Galaxy. They want to protect it. That's their right. if they catch their breath and go, you know, do a proper investigation of the movies, take the co-stars into account, take the temperature of the water and see if people are thinking maybe they jumped the gun a little bit, since the guy has acknowledged this in the past repeatedly and said how stupid and awful it was, and he's worked hard to amend that and shown actions that show he's amended that, you know, then maybe you take a different tack and maybe you catch your breath and say, finish the script and maybe we'll talk later.
Well, and there is a petition right now on change.org. It's up to, I think, 138,832. And literally, as I'm saying this, it's like watching a gas meter go. Like,
right. Well, you know, that's those fans who like the movies. They don't care what he said. But, you know, your studio, you want to protect your property. You don't want to be linked to a guy making jokes about pedophilia and rape. So, yeah, but this, you know, see what it happens. Maybe they jump the gun a little bit. It doesn't mean they approve of the comments. It doesn't. But, you know, if you acknowledge them, you apologize, you show a track record of being better than that. Some people say, hey, sometimes you're supposed to forgive and move on. Right. But that may not happen in Chicago. The Broadway show Chicago had a tragedy where an actor killed himself after a rehearsal for the show. He's been a standby on the show for 22 years. He's been there since the original cast, and people were outraged and upset because they found notes from him describing what he said was belittling treatment during a rehearsal period with the director, Walter Bobby, who's the original director of the show and had come back to tighten it up and check up on things. This guy basically has been there for 22 years. They can't fire you. You're locked in with the show. As long as the show keeps running, you get to stay with the show. That's a pretty standard clause. And after all this time, it's possible he was getting more and more money, because over the years, the longer you stay with the show, the more money you make. So there is the possibility that people suggest they wanted to get him out because they felt like he was too old for the part. It'd been too long. He wasn't up to snuff, and maybe he was making too much money. You know, friends are outraged. They're looking for action. The producers launched an investigation after his suicide. They brought in an investigator, but their investigator is a guy that's done work for the producers before. So the other people are like, that's not an independent investigator. So Actors Equity has hired their own investigator, their own lawyer. They are not cooperating, and they're telling their people, don't cooperate with the investigator that represents the producers, because he's in their pocket. Even if he wants to do an independent investigation, you can't trust that because he works for them on a regular basis. So they're looking into it. Michael Rydell did a story in the New York Post trying to throw some water on this. And he says, look, you know, there are people who are saying there must have been some other reason why this guy killed himself, and just the fact that he was belittled during this rehearsal. To which everyone would say, well, I'm sure there was, but nonetheless, should he be belittled at a rehearsal? You know, so it's a very touchy issue. But once this story came out, a lot of people started sharing their stories online about really being belittled and harassed and mocked and treated like dirt by directors and producers working on shows on Broadway. So it's a long-term project to end that sort of abuse. And what does it have to do with sexual harassment and assault? It's the same story. When you're allowed to treat people like dirt, you're also allowed to treat them like sexual objects. If you see one happening, like on my iHeart Huckabees, you should stop it, because it's not acceptable, however talented the director or producer or star may be.
Well, one could hardly disagree with you on that.
Let's hope so.
But that wraps up our sexual misconduct segment for this week and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? Well, looks like Mickey Mouse is going on strike.
Aha, Minnie, strike, strike, strike.
Well, okay, it's not Mickey Mouse. It's the voice actors who bring to life the characters in TV animation who are going on strike. SAG-AFTRA members just overwhelmingly voted to approve a strike for actors doing TV voice over work on animated titles. The strike will affect all TV animation, but the target is the streaming services like Netflix and Hulu and the gazillion others launching soon, like Disney and the Warner Brothers animation outlet Boomerang. Those SVOD services don't pay scale wages or residuals, and, you know, obviously that has to change. Negotiations are ongoing. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I was going to do that in Goofy's voice, but I decided not to. But we've seen this story before. You switch to a new format. Oh, DVDs. We'll never make money on these. You have to take a lower rate. The idea that people should be taking a cut rate, that Netflix has $8 billion to spend, but they get a cut rate on voice actors? No.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
No.
Because you know what? If you start at a cut rate, you never wind up reaching your pay scale.
Right.
Now, Comic-Con is going on right now. I think, or maybe did it end today? I don't know. But at Comic-Con, it's not enough to show trailers and bring out the stars of your movie or TV show. No, now you need to activate fans and quote-unquote
Wonder Twin Powers, activate. It's form not, of a whale, shape of an iceberg.
It's not really that kind of activation. Activations, as they are called in the industry, were all the rage at Comic-Con. Call them interactive exhibits, displays, rides, or whatever you want, but they were the big story at this year's event. Amazon's Jack Ryan offered up a 4D VR ride that people waited hours to experience. Game of Thrones was simpler, a photo op on the actual throne everyone is vying for. DC showed off costumes, created a rage room dedicated to Harley Quinn, an escape room for Ward Dick Grayson, and an obstacle course for Swamp Thing fans. And on they went. Each one was more elaborate and thrill-seeking than the last. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh my God, is this a big whoop? I'm like, why is Hollywood Reporter suddenly saying activation? What the heck is an activation?
It's just a brand new, new term, or not so brand new, frankly. It's a marketing term.
I've never noticed it. It's obnoxious. It's like, you get to sit in the Game of Thrones chair. Oh, it's an activation. I mean, just, you know, stop glomming onto every new word, Hollywood. IP, IP, IP. Oh, shut up. That's what I'd say. It just drives me nuts when they get a new word and can't stop saying it.
Yeah, I mean, so basically it's a way of what
I got it. Yeah. I got it.
I'm just letting our listeners know.
Stuff. So you can go, oh, look, Game of Thrones. Oh, look, you know, Swamp Thing. I get it. But activation is ridiculous.
Effectively, the way it had always been explained to me was that it was as if you were telling somebody of the property, whether it be toilet paper or a movie, for the first time and making them aware of it, thus activating it in their mind.
But this is for fans who are already existing. It's not for newcomers.
Yes, in this case, the activation is referring to actually allowing a customer, so to speak, to engage with the brand, to engage with the property.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, what was that word you used? Big whoop.
Marketing. It's marketing.
Dame Diana Rigg is out of My Fair Lady. The musical revival has been gaining steam at the box office ever since it opened on Broadway and is now a solid, if not spectacular, hit, grossing more than $1 million a week, selling out most performances and quietly raising ticket prices at the same time. But it hit rough waters when Rigg took Lauren Ambrose, who is one of the stars of My Fair Lady.
She's the star.
Well, she took her to task for suddenly ditching Sunday matinees. Rigg stood by her comments, saying she was an old broad and could speak her mind. Rigg said it wasn't fair to the theatergoers who had purchased tickets, and Ambrose's comments about missing her family and the strain of doing the role 8 shows a week wouldn't cut it. I don't know why I'm doing it in that voice, but she knew what she was in for, said Rigg. But maybe Rigg didn't. The show abruptly announced Rigg would leave the show September 9th and that a replacement would be announced shortly. Michael will be doing that role until they can find a replacement. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, Diana Rigg is leaving the show? Damn. I've grown accustomed to her face. Yes, this is a big deal. I mean, this was a boot, baby. This is, you know, oof. We're showing who the star is on this show. Diana Rigg is a Tony-winning legend, and to kick her to the curb, which is what they're doing, is kind of amazing. It's, you know, there's no other way to put this. If this was when they were going to replace her and she was going to leave, originally scheduled, they would have the replacement person ready. They would know. They would say Diana Rigg is leaving and blah, blah, blah. Judi Dench is joining. Not that it would ever be Judi Dench, but somebody like that, they'd say they're joining. They would not have it like this, where she's gone, and we'll tell you the replacement when we figure out what to do. This is clearly her being kicked out of the show because of what happened. Obviously, backstage, tensions were high. And you know what? Diana Rigg was right. You know, what should have happened is Lauren Ambrose said, I'm pulling back from the show. It's too much. I miss my family, the strain of doing the vocals, blah, blah, blah. Diana Rigg is old school and said, you know what? When we couldn't even speak, we would work 8 shows a week. We'd rasp our way through the show. It's true. Maybe it's too much for her. And I would understand that for Lauren Ambrose, but they shouldn't have, you know, they've been selling the show with her in it. She is the star of the show. So all these people who bought tickets deserve more than, oh, tough noogies. You know, it's a big deal to suddenly say you're going to be in the show, you buy a ticket to see that star, and they're not there anymore. So there just should have been more humbleness about it and less like tough, everybody take it, and more, oh my God, I feel terrible and this shouldn't happen. But you know, it's, you know, stars in the past would ruin their voices by doing 8 shows a week, you know, pushing themselves to extremes. If she can't handle it, that's okay. But it is a big pain for the theater goers who bought that ticket believing they would see Lauren Ambrose.
Well, think about it this way. I remember buying a ticket to Parsifal. Okay. This is the,
ooh,
the,
yeah,
the Wagner opera. I think it lasts about 900 days.
Oh, and, I love it. I love it. It makes me weep.
Yeah. And, you know, Placido Domingo, it's his signature role. It was going to be performed here in Los Angeles. I had bought a ticket. The show, it's so long. It started at 5 p.m. so that they could do the whole show. Okay. The whole opera. People flew in from out of town. That's how this production was, you know, ramped up.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I know I've told this story on the show before, but who is the first voice I should hear on stage that night?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. It was Placido Domingo in what sounded like a taped recording saying he could not perform that night.
Oh, what a sad, sad day.
The groan. I just thought, oh my God, the poor guy who has to come out now. Just
that's not the only theater news. Dreamgirls, that's coming to Broadway, it looks like. They announced an exploratory casting call for a New York production of Dreamgirls, which has been done in London with Amber Riley from Glee, making a great stage debut as a leading lady in the UK production of Dreamgirls. She did a great job. And if she can be consistent in her appearances on the show, because she had some trouble with being in and out, that would be great. So that show, they've done this twice before, but the show is ending its run in London on January 19th, which means it'd be ripe for coming to New York, you know, April or May, just in time for the Tony Awards. And they're doing another exploratory casting call, so that could happen. And another one for Lin-Manuel Miranda. He is going to make his film directorial debut, and he's going to be directing Jonathan Larson's musical Tick, Tick, Boom, which is an autobiographical musical about a guy who wants to be a Broadway composer.
Well, then talk about autobiographical. He was a Broadway composer.
Jonathan Larson. Yes, that's why it's called autobiographical.
Yes. Well, I have a PhD in the obvious. Have I ever told you?
No.
Now, Netflix is getting serious. The streaming service just beat HBO by snagging more Emmy nominations. The first time the cable channel has been beaten in 18 years. FYI, see last week's episode. Now, Netflix would like to win a major Emmy. Thank you very much. They want to win the top dog, best drama, or best comedy. And a major Oscar would be nice too, by the way. In walks Tayback, Lisa Tayback, that is. She is arguably the biggest name in awards season strategizing, working with the Weinsteins for many years and then going off on her own and branching out into TV, including NBC's campaign to break back into the best drama nominees with This Is Us. If you've got a potential winner, you want Lisa Tayback. And now Netflix has her. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but in the world of TV award shows and award shows in general, it's a very big deal. Will she have time to do movie stuff as well? Will Netflix want her to do movie stuff? Will they want more movies to be shown in theaters because she can get them an actual Oscar? Be interesting to see what happens. And hey, you know what? Maybe she can freelance for podcast awards as well. Maybe we can get her for that.
I think they do have podcast awards, actually. We should put ourselves up for that, for Pete's sake.
Darn right we should. And, you know, she might be campaigning for Bruce Springsteen because he's got a Netflix concert. His Broadway show is coming to Netflix. And that, you know what, Springsteen, he's got an Oscar, a Grammy, and a special Tony. That's an asterisk, but still, he got a special Tony. So if he gets an Emmy, he's an EGOT.
An EGOT, that's right. So now, you know, the thing with Netflix and their awards, they did so much FYC, and you want to talk about a word of the day. You were talking about activations. FYC is the new black here in Hollywood.
Instead of saying for your consideration, it's
exactly.
Been around for 80 years. How is it new?
No, it's new because I said it was new, darn it.
Okay.
So they rented out entire buildings for FYC events and for the entire like 2-3 month run before the Emmy nominations. They had, you know, a string. You couldn't walk down a block that didn't have a Netflix FYC event.
Well, that seems like a pretty inexpensive play because you only do it in LA and maybe New York. So it seems like a smart thing to do. You know, billboards and things, they don't cost that much. You got $8 billion to play with, you know, a campaign for Emmys with some billboards and stuff in New York and LA. Why not?
I want to see, forget about Bruce Springsteen, even though I love Bruce Springsteen. And, well, we're not going to talk about how we had to sell the tickets we had to that Broadway show because they cost like $1 trillion. But it would be great if we could get Roy Orbison to win an Emmy now.
Well, you know what Bruce Springsteen said. He wanted to write like Dylan, shake his hips like Elvis, and sing like Roy Orbison. And he said that was crazy because nobody sings like Roy Orbison.
That's right. And, you know, thankfully, we can now experience that because Roy Orbison is going on tour. The Hall of Fame rock and roller kicks off an intimate string of theater dates with an October 1st show in Oakland. And that's Oakland, California. He's going to be that's going to be followed by an October 2nd date in Los Angeles at the Wiltern.
Will you go see him?
You know what? I've got to be honest. I might try and get a press ticket to this because I just want to see it. It ends November 19th with a show in Clearwater, Florida, and then heads to Branson, Missouri for an open-ended run at the Andy Williams Moon River Theater. While the musicians will be performing live, of course, Orbison died 30 years ago this December, so he'll be performing via hologram. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's kind of one of the bigger tours we've had so far from a hologram. And it's Roy Orbison. Not a big draw at the concert scene. It's not Michael Jackson or Frank Sinatra. Roy Orbison toured, I am sure, nonstop throughout his life, and I never got to see him. It's a shame. But he wasn't playing big arenas. You know, he's a legend in rock and roll, a string of amazing singles, but not a huge draw. But he makes sense sort of at the Branson, Missouri level. And in a couple venues, I guess, to work out the kinks. And I guess he could be a draw there, but I guess the cost of holograms, this is an example. If they can roll the dice on Roy Orbison as opposed to, say, Elvis, then that means the cost must be coming down enough to do a good job at a smaller venue where you can make still make money.
I just want to see how they do it technically.
Right. Of course. Yeah. You really should try and get tickets because I'm thinking, you know, you'd be really interesting to report on for Celluloid Junkie and for us as far as how what the viability of it is. Just the fact, though, it can't be that expensive or they wouldn't be doing it with Roy Orbison.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I'm serious. I mean, he's a legend. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he is not a guy who was packing, you know, 20,000 arenas or football stadiums. Never did it in his entire career. So, you know, doing a hologram tour of Roy Orbison. Hey, he's a, you know, Patsy Cline, Roy Orbison. These are, you know, trademark names. What is the word? They're IP, baby. They're IP. You know, so they are very marketable, but they're not huge. So it's an interesting thing. I'd love to know the cost.
Okay. Well, director Robert LePage is back in the news for the second time in a month. In fact, the acclaimed Canadian director Robert LePage is under fire for casting. First, a highly touted show about Canada's history of slavery was shut down at the Montreal Jazz Festival over protests that most of the slaves were played, you know, by white people. Now, a new show by LePage shining a spotlight on Canada's treatment of Indigenous people is being blasted too. Called Kanata, it features 34 actors, none of whom are Indigenous. Scheduled for Paris and then Quebec, one defender said Hamlet doesn't have to be played by a Danish person, okay?
That's a dumb comment.
That didn't go over very well, by the way. LePage and the producers will meet with activists for a dialogue, pointing out that the cast is diverse and the show incorporates video testimony from Indigenous people and that they had consulted widely with Indigenous leaders. I want to somehow get the word aboot in here. You know, so is this a big deal or a big whoop?
So I avoided the first controversy that happened a few weeks ago about white people playing slaves. I thought, oh, it's too much, too elaborate to get into. But then a few weeks later, suddenly he's got to play with 34 roles and none of them are Indigenous. You have to work hard. You had to like turn them away at the door. My God, you're doing a play about Indigenous people and none of the actors are Indigenous. Well, there aren't a ton of, I imagine the pool of Indigenous actors in Canada is probably not huge, but they're there. Just like you can find Native Americans, if you want to cast them, they're ready and waiting to work. So it does seem a little tacky to happen two shows right in a row, just a few weeks after each other. He's obviously blindsided. He's like, I'm trying to do these important, you know, progressive works, celebrating, you know, the horrors of slavery and shining a light on how Canada was poor and we had slaves and shining a light on our poor treatment of Indigenous people. Why are people attacking me like I'm the problem? It's a changing world, though. You know, you want to talk about Indigenous people, it helps to have some of them on stage.
You know, you say that there's, you know, Native American actors, and Graham Greene would agree with you.
Yes, exactly. Well, there are many others than Graham Greene.
I agree, but that would not have made the joke work.
Uh-huh.
Now, this next story. Oh, my goodness. In a surprise move, the FCC is raising a serious concern about the Sinclair merger with Tribune that will give it immense control over local news around the country. To allay any doubters, Sinclair had announced that it would sell off a number of stations in key markets. Okay, that's pretty good of them, you know? The problem was that Sinclair was virtually selling stations, the stations that it agreed to part with. They were selling them to Sinclair, okay? That's what they were doing. They were setting up dummy businesses to sell off the stations to, maintaining control and reserving the right to, you know, buy them back outright in years to come. That's kind of like not selling them at all, said FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, who suddenly sided with the lone Democrat dissenting to the deal. Sinclair was shocked to find the FCC might have problems with it sort of not actually selling off the TV stations, and promised to amend the deal and make everyone happy. Big deal or big whoop?
It'll be a big deal if they block the merger. Until then, it's just all a show.
Yeah, God, it would be amazing if they could block this merger.
But I have to tell you, I watch local news here in Alabama. It's a Sinclair station. And I suddenly saw one of their, you know, dropped in national, you know, propaganda pieces. you wouldn't know, but I'm a little savvier. So I know, oh, look, they just did a handover. And this is just a taped segment that is not from the local news station. And it's all saying how wonderful the government is, what great things they are doing. It is really creepy, frankly. I don't care what party you're from. That's creepy. You know, I thought it was creepy if it was under a Democrat. It's just creepy to have local news forced to carry little puff pieces praising the government. That's just wrong.
Yeah, those pieces are must-carry pieces.
Yeah, really, really creepy. And most people will not notice what's going on. They'll just think it's another story.
Now, Amazon has greenlit a new sci-fi series called Tales from the Loop. Nathaniel Halpern of Legion will be the showrunner. Like so many new TV shows and films, Tales from the Loop is based on something else.
Oh, here we go again. Another comic book or novel or previous, blah, blah, blah. What's it this time?
Well, full credit to Amazon. It's not based on a comic book or a sci-fi novel or a pre-existing TV series from another country. It's not based on a short story or a play. Or get this, it's not even based on a poem, okay?
What?
Yeah, no. Tales from the Loop is based on a painting, or rather the body of work by Swedish artist Simon Stålenhag, whose work combines images of bucolic rural life with sci-fi elements such as a barn with some alien craft in the background, or cars driving down the road alongside far more fantastical machines. Up next for Amazon, two new anthology series, Norman Rockwell's America and Roy Lichtenstein's Tale of Love and Heartbreak. Is that true? Because he's one of my favorite patrons. Okay, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's fun to see. It's you know, it's interesting. I'm just surprised James Cameron didn't have to get the rights from Maxville Parrish when he did Avatar. But anyway, I think it's cool. It shows them, you know, thinking outside the box. So that's neat to see. But talking about a TV show inspired by a painting reminded me of what was said last week. Last week on the show, Jeff Boucher mentioned in passing two things. In one of them, he niftily corrected my mistake. I said V, the Last Man, in talking about comic books, and he quickly renamed them properly and said V for Vendetta and Y, the Last Man. Those are two separate elements, two separate comic books. Thank you for that, Jeff. Number two, he mentioned that Ridley Scott was inspired when he did Gladiator by a painting. You know, and that was Thumbs Down by the French painter Jean-Léon Gérôme, with a painting that was done in 1872. And our in-house historian, Aaron Rich, made two points. One, this was first reported in Premier Magazine, and done by Alex Lewin, a reporter who interviewed Ridley Scott and got this little nugget out of him. And it's been repeated ad nauseum ever since. And in fact, I know Alex Lewin, so I should have mentioned that. I didn't know. I forgot that was his story. So cool for him. That's been repeated 1,000 times ever since. And to be more specific, the producers of the movie showed him the painting when they were trying to get him on board with making this movie. They had a script already. They showed him the painting, said, make a gladiator movie. And Ridley Scott said, that's a great idea. But would be more accurate to say, everyone has been inspired by that painting. That in painting from 1872, thumbs down, shows the gladiator and the emperor doing thumbs down, meaning kill the guy you've just defeated. And that was arguably one of the most, if not the most famous image of the late 1800s into the 1900s. It was reprinted endlessly. Everybody knew it. Everybody saw it. And every gladiator film from the first silent movie right up to Gladiator was inspired by that painting. Everybody referenced that painting. Everybody knew that image. So yes, Ridley Scott was inspired, but he's just following in the wake of every other gladiator epic ever made, like Spartacus, and you can name it.
Wow, that is a good painting. You're right.
Yeah, no, it's a great painting. It's very, you've probably seen it or you've seen something like it. You know, so there you go.
It's Polis Verso.
Yes.
That's the name of the painting in its original language.
That's right.
And it was not done with an emoticon or an emoji. No thumbs down emoji. Okay, now Drake's new album, Scorpion, sits atop the Billboard album charts for the third week in a row. Billboard also says hip-hop, broadly defined, is the pop music of this era, completely dominating the album and singles chart. In fact, we're thinking of just wrapping this podcast to try and reach more listeners in the 18 to 35 demo.
This is not going to work.
Okay, but rap is definitely the sound of today. Wiz Khalifa's Rolling Papers 2. You see, Michael, they even music has sequels and franchises now. They have IP, you see. How did Drake stay on top? Well, he sold 29,000 copies of his album and enjoyed 260,000 in equivalent album sales thanks to digital singles and streaming. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Drake has a big new album, but I really think they are measuring album sales wrong. As we know, if you sell an album on CD or digitally or vinyl, that counts as an album sale. But they've also got this separate thing where they say, okay, if you sell 10 digital singles of any tracks on the album, that counts as another album sale.
So then the baseline is 10. You need 10 right. of something, whether it's right. digital sales or we're going to talk about streaming, I'm sure. But right. 10 is the album.
No, 10 digital tracks being sold is right. the album. If 10 people buy the single Nice For What, they say, okay, that's equivalent to an album sale.
Right.
Which to me is goofy. It should be if you buy most of the tracks on the album, that would constitute an album sale. Why one song being really popular should constitute an album sale, I don't get. He's got 25 tracks on the album. If you don't buy 13 of them, you haven't bought the album. If everybody's buying one or two singles, then those are really popular singles, but that shouldn't equal an album sale. It shouldn't be any 10 random tracks. It should be 51% of the tracks on the album.
Okay, but then you also have streaming.
Right, and in streaming, what they say is if tracks are streamed 1,500 times, that equals an album sale.
So but if tracks from that album are streamed 1,500 times, doesn't matter what track it is from that album, then right, it's 1,500 equals one album sale.
Right, but again, if the song Nice For What is streamed 1 billion times and no other song on the album is played once, why the heck would that constitute an album sale? In my mind, they should simply say, you know what? Those are just popular singles. Unless you stream a majority of the tracks on the album, you haven't listened to the album. So to get to 1,500 streams, you should have to listen to either the album or at least 51% of the tracks. Because if there are 25 tracks on this album, if you don't listen to 13 tracks, if you just play the same four tracks over and over again, you're not listening to the album, and it should never equal an album sale. It seems obvious to me. And you know what? This is why this darn album has 25 tracks on it. It would have been a better album at about 14 tracks. And a lot of critics complain. Chris Brown's album had 40 tracks on it. Why? Because the more tracks on your album, the quicker and easier you can get to 1,500 streams.
I see. So there's you're basically gaming the system.
Exactly. That's why people are shoving so many tracks on their album. That will pass, just like CDs were shoved full of music once in a while because they thought, oh, there's 60 minutes. We better fill it up. It didn't matter what was good creatively. They were just doing it because they thought they should. Now they're doing it to game the streaming system. And that will pass because artists will realize, you know what, the best way to have long-term success is to create a really good album. It's not to shove it full of singles. So that will pass. But nonetheless, it points up the problem of streaming and how they're counting album sales. The only thing that should constitute an album stream is when you listen to most of the tracks on the album. It may take days or weeks. Maybe you listen to 4 tracks and then 15 a week later, but they know who you are and they can track that. And if you do it again and again, that's okay. If you keep playing a majority of the tracks over and over again, that will constitute an album stream. And then when you have 1,500 of those or whatever number you want, then that equals an album sale. But it shouldn't be just one track played a billion times, because that doesn't make any sense.
Well, your explanation of it made sense. So, but that's almost like a deep dive into the music business there. And our deep dives are usually reserved for Inside Baseball. And it is indeed time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And really, today, we're stepping back to note the long-term trends that have been changing TV for years. None of this is surprising, but it is a titanic shift and it's still happening. So in a way, how will this affect you? It's already affected you, and now we're just kind of reiterating it. It's a modest Inside Baseball.
That's right. It's modest. Why don't I set up and then you can go in more deeply. There's a couple, three things we're looking at. One, 40 years after the introduction of the VCR in U.S. homes, way back in the 1970s, TV viewers in the U.S. are finally turning away from live TV. I've been thinking the surveys haven't been capturing how people are actually watching TV for a long time, but even now, finally, the surveys agree with me that people are not watching live TV. A majority of the people are using DVRs or on demand or streaming rather than live TV. That's a huge change. It's a long time coming. Number two, overseas, more households in the UK subscribe to a streaming service rather than a traditional pay TV service like cable or satellite TV. They are saying, I don't want a cable provider with 100 channels. I just want Netflix or Netflix and Hulu. More people are paying for streaming rather than a big package like they used to. The bigger that happens, the more hard it's going to be to make money off people. You know what? I mean, cable packages have 50, 100, 500 channels. Streaming services just have 1 or 2 or 5. So that's a big change. And finally, niche sports like arm wrestling and archery and karate and bull riding are finding a home on streaming services. So that's really where the action is for a lot of reasons. So let's look at the trend first from live TV.
Well, live TV, an annual survey has been tracking where, when, how people are consuming TV. And the latest results suggest that people in North America, they have finally stopped doing what they've been doing since TV began. They've stopped turning on the TV and just seeing what's on. For a still hefty 39% of viewers, that's still their first choice, a drop of another 8 points from the 47% who said the same thing 1 year ago. 1 year ago, 47% of people were sitting down on the couch with the remote control, kind of going, hey, what's on?
Now, Drives me nuts.
Now 39%. Now a substantial majority. They turn off, they turn first to, you know, on demand. Then there's their DVR and streaming services like Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon. The older you are, the more likely you are to still just flop in a chair and turn on the TV. But that number dropped substantially. Of course, the younger you are, the less likely, only 26% of people 18 to 34 are passive watchers. That's interesting.
Yes. I mean, this has just been such a long time coming. My God. I mean, I don't know why, you know, with DVR and VCR, I don't know why anybody would watch live TV unless it was something like the Oscars or live sports. And even then, I can't handle watching local baseball game because it takes so long. But dear God, this is a long time coming. I think we're lagging behind actual usage and what people have actually been doing, because I just can't imagine it's taken this long. But thank God we're finally getting there.
Well, I know Walmart, you know, they have this Voodoo, right? It's the service that they it's a company they picked up, and they've been, it's kind of a subscription video on demand as it is now, right? But it's like pay-per-view. Now they're thinking of launching a service more like Netflix where you pay monthly.
I mean, there are, I know they want to charge $8 a month, just like Netflix, but they have no information on, well, what are they going to show? Are they going to create content? Are they going to buy libraries? Have they bought anything? How much money are they going to put into this? It just seems very, very sketchy.
And remember, Walmart is a retailer that is based, it's a discount retailer. It's known for turning to its vendors, turning to its manufacturers and saying, listen, you sold me that shirt for $10 last
make
year.
Make it nine.
Yes, make it nine. And you know what? Hollywood doesn't say, hey, Tom Cruise, you know, we paid you $20 million for the last film. We're going to pay you $19 million now because we need... That's not the way Hollywood works. It goes the exact opposite direction. The more successful you are, the more money you make.
But I picture Walmart doing a play if they're going to do this, which is still highly up in the air. But I would imagine them buying libraries of old stuff.
Yeah,
I don't think they're going to start... They're going to say, you know what? There's a bunch of libraries out there. We're happy to share them with other people. There's all these cable channels that people aren't watching anymore. We'll share whatever Nick at Night has. We'll share whatever, you know, TV Land has. We'll share what, you know, I think there's a lot of libraries that maybe they could rent and, you know, share to their listeners.
Well, let's look at how people in the UK are favoring streaming services over pay TV, because just so you understand, they're still paying for TV, okay? But they're choosing Netflix and they're choosing Amazon Prime and Sky Now instead of cable or satellite packages. I mean, for the first time, that's actually the first time in history that's happened, that more households in the UK subscribe to streaming services like the Netflix and the Amazon Prime than pay TV services like Sky. Now, remember, there's that big fight over who will own Sky, whether it's going to be Comcast or Fox or, you know, so that, you know, I don't even know how
and
many.
And then Fox, it goes to Disney.
Right. So British Telecom also has a pay TV service. Virgin has a pay TV service. But now, more residents of the UK pay for streaming services than any of those three. And it's a close race. I mean, streaming boasts 15.4 million subscribers, while traditional has 15.1. So, you know, it's split by hairs here. But the trend is clear. Another trend, young people are watching significantly less video content overall. Oh,
that's interesting. That's interesting.
And the amount of money being spent on programming by traditional broadcasters like the BBC and Channel 4, it's hit a modern low. Okay, they're coughing up $3.3 billion annually, which is more than $1 billion less than the peak amount spent in 2004.
Okay, a couple things. One, I'm shocked at young people watching less video content overall. If they mean all video content, like YouTube stuff, you know, and that's surprising to me, because no matter what you see, they may be dividing their attention between traditional TV and streaming and just scrolling through YouTube, but they're still watching more and more content, or tons of content. To know that it's dropped substantially, we don't have good figures on that, but that surprises me. The other thing I wonder, which I couldn't figure out, was whether they are factoring in the fact that you can get great TV from just, you know, your BBC and, you know, traditional over-the-top services. Is over-the-top the phrase I want? No, it's not. It's not like antenna, but I don't know what to call it. But you know, you can
over the air.
I mean, yeah, you can just get sort of over the air stuff. It's going to be through a cable or whatever. I don't think you need to subscribe to British Telecom to get like the BBC and whatever is, you know, nationally subsidized when you pay your TV license. So it may be a factor where people already have a good basic cable service that they're happy with, and therefore when they add on, instead of getting Sky or British Telecom or Virgin, they're choosing just to add on Netflix or Amazon Prime. They don't just have Netflix or Amazon Prime. They all have basic TV like you don't have in the US. I mean, you can put an antenna out the window, but basically, unless you subscribe to a cable provider, you don't have anything. So, you know, we're not choosing.
Is over the air, but how good
yeah,
it
is. Yeah, but people don't do that really here. And I'm thinking they do in the UK because you pay that UK TV license and therefore you may have access.
And things are closer together, so it's a lot easier to get the actual signal.
Right. And finally, it's really upsetting to hear that they're cutting so much in content spending. I'm surprised at that because, like we said before, the British punch way above their weight. Their TV programming is watched all over the world. It's a great export. They make a ton of money off it, but you have to invest in it before you can sell it.
Well, speaking of investing, okay, the New York Times has a fun story about niche sports finding an audience by offering themselves up as a streaming services. So I guess that, you know, there are these like MMA and arm wrestling federations that want you to spend a little money on them.
Right. Well, MMA, of course, has big cable deals. They've taken over boxing as far as the violent sport of choice today in America. But there are competitors like full contact karate. This group called Karate Combat. It's a full contact karate league. To me, it's indistinguishable from MMA, though I'm sure they would say, no, it's completely different. But they have the rights to karate.com. I thought their website would be karatecombat.com. But no, they've got karate.com. That must have cost a pretty penny. And they've just launched this new league. They had a preseason in February. They had an event in April in Miami. And now they're going to Athens. in like July 28th. They're going to be in Athens, and they only have a couple hundred people in attendance, but they film it really well. It's in a sunken pit. It's sort of meant to look like Street Fighter, frankly. But they do really good graphics. They have chats online, and basically they're not trying to get with the TV network. They're just saying, hey, we've got a streaming service online, access us that way. And that's where we're going to make our money. They're not even, you know, they're like, well, okay, we don't need an audience, which is the traditional way sports make money. We don't need people to show up. We just need people to watch online. So, you know, will it work? I don't know. I mean, they talk about arm wrestling, jujitsu, wrestling, all these different little niche sports that are going to work online. The fact is, I feel like you get an audience online when you have people who really want to see it live as well, but they just can't make it. So it seems a little backwards to me. But I guess if you're creating good TV product, you don't need to work hard at having a big fan base that comes out to shows every time. You just need to have good TV product.
Yeah, I can't wait for my knitting club to have its own streaming service.
Hey, I don't know. We never got the slow TV movement here in the U.S., did we? They have people who knit, people who show video walking out a train, right? You know, you just take a train ride from Stockholm to wherever, and they have 4 hours on the air of just the train ride. They show what you see out the window. That's been big hits in the Netherlands. So they have knitting shows, and it could happen.
Is it the Netherlands? I thought it was like Norway or Sweden.
Oh, I get it wrong. I don't know. I'm terrible on geography, but I do know that Japan lost a great writer this week.
That's right. This is our obituary section, and Shinobu Hashimoto. He is a screenwriter of Kurosawa's Seven Samurai and Rashomon. He died at the age of 100. He wrote or co-wrote more than 70 screenplays.
That's right. I mean, this is a legendary screenwriter. His first screenplay, his first credit was Rashomon. Well, that's a hell of a way to start, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that's been copied a zillion times.
That's right. It's a landmark work, bringing Japanese cinema to the world, establishing it as an international phenomenon, opening the door for everything that has come since then. He wrote Seven Samurai, one of the great westerns of all time. Of course, it was began as a samurai film, then got translated into The Magnificent Seven. He wrote Throne of Blood, The Hidden Fortress, which inspired Star Wars in part. You know, this is a very, very talented writer. Kurosawa had teams of writers on a lot of his movies, so not all of his credits are solo. So he often co-wrote with a lot of other people, and he collaborated with other directors. He even directed some movies himself, three movies in particular, but he'll be remembered primarily as a screenwriter and especially for his work for Kurosawa.
You know what he would say right now if he were alive? He'd say, "Of course none of my screenwriting credits were solo. I would never have written that movie."
What do you mean?
Solo,
what?
The movie.
Oh,
Solo.
Oh, dear God. Okay, I got it.
You see, you've already forgotten the movie.
Oh, it must be time to end.
My jokes are going over as well, I suppose. Okay, well, you know what? If you like, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to our show, and we do actually urge you to do so. Please rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help others find the show. It helps us out when you do. That information,
it makes our mother happy.
Yes, indeed. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, as well as ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. Or like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a different website every single week. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's iwroterashomon.com.
You know, from my vantage point, I think I wrote Rashomon. And if you haven't seen Rashomon and you watch Rashomon, you'll understand that joke. But if you haven't read any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, michaelgiltz.com might be a better place to go, because that's where it's all aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.